Hey guys, you know how important sponsors are to the podcast, not because they're just sponsors, but because they're partners of Philcraft Survival. Good people and good companies. No exception coming from firecracker.farm. You guys might have seen me using this on social media before we partnered with these guys. I loved it because I love spicy food. It's a push grinder that has hot salt and has three different peppers infused. It's got the good old Ghost Trinidad and Carolina Reaper peppers. So not for the weak or faint-hearted. I use it on all the food. You could take it camping. I've taken it overlanding. I've used it in the last mobility experience. If you go to firecracker.farm and use coupon code PhilCraft, one word, PhilCraft, one word, you can save 15% on your first order. Again, firecracker.farm, use PhilCraft as a coupon code. PhilCraft, one word, to save 15% on your next purchase. Thanks, guys.
Hey guys, welcome to the PhilCraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host for this advertisement space. I just want to appreciate and recognize one of our sponsors. And I'll tell you something about sponsors. Like, we work at a company that is in the outdoor space, and you know, we get people that throw stuff our way all the time. And you know, every so often I'll get something where I'm like, man, this is a really cool product. I'm excited I got an opportunity to test it out. And then sometimes I'll get a product that crosses my desk or you know, lands in my lap, and I'm like, nah, not for me, maybe for someone else. It's pretty interesting with Vertex, who is the sponsor of this podcast. They have like a universal appeal here at Fieldcraft where, you know, I like their clothing. I like their mag pouches. Whenever I go to the range, I always have mags loaded up in mag pouches. You know, all my Glock mags go there. And then that way they're not like rattling around inside the bottom of my range bag. And, you know, I know some of the other folks, they like the weapons bags that you can carry, you know, short-barreled rifles and short-barreled pistols and things like that. Short-barreled pistol, that's not even technically a thing. AR pistol, how about that? So Vertex is one of those companies that, you know, we consider them friends. Like, we see them at trade shows, they're good people. And there's always something that you can find that you're going to use. Now, I don't have one of the new Recce shirts. I'm hoping our marketing department will send me one at some point, or maybe Vertex will. So Vertex, if you're listening, I wear a size extra large, and you can just find our address on the Fieldcraft Survival website for North Carolina. So if you guys are interested in checking out Vertex, go to the Vertex website, and you can use the coupon code FIELDCRAFT, spelled just like Fieldcraft Survival, Fieldcraft, and you'll get 20% off of your order. Like I said, they make some really good stuff. You know, you're going to find some products that you might be able to incorporate into your lifestyle, into your mobility platform, into your backpack, into your hunting setup, whatever it may be. Please check them out. They're good people. That's vertex.com. That's V-E-R-T-X. Use the coupon code Fieldcraft and you'll get 20% off. Also, big shout out to all the instructors we've got on the Fieldcraft team. You guys do the thankless job of getting out there in the rain and the muck, doing all that great stuff, putting in a lot of hours. So shout out to, you know, anyone that is teaching for us on the range, mobility stuff, med stuff, survival stuff. Appreciate all of you guys everywhere from one coast to the other. Guys, please check out Fieldcraft Survival. Go to the training tab on the website, and you can find training in your backyard. Most likely we're in the process of loading up more courses, and you'll find something that will help level you up. All right, let's get down to this podcast. Here we go. Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm here recording in Aberdeen, North Carolina. Guys, we got a lot of awesome training that we do out of this office. There's stuff that you can do out west. You know, you can hang out in Utah. You can hang out in Colorado with Vandy, and you can go down to Arizona with Doc Jones. But of course, I'm going to tell you to come down here and train with me and Jerry and Rick Lofton and Kate Smith and Brian Edwards and Adam Neep out in Kentucky, all the cool crew that we got here on the East Coast. So guys, please, please check out the website, go to Fieldcraft Survival Training /training and take a look at what we have coming up. Guys, this podcast is going to be a fun one. This is actually a part two with a good friend of mine. You know, as a podcaster, I get a lot of feedback from you guys. And of course, I want to bring you what you want to hear. And last year I podcasted this guy, and a lot of people messaged me and they're like, that was one of the most interesting podcasts. I wish you asked him questions about XYZ. And the reason for that is because my podcast guest last year, who I'm referring to, is a doctor, not only a doctor, a surgeon. who also happens to be an outdoorsman. And to catch everyone up to speed, he and I have been good friends for close to 20 years. And he's someone who, you know, I'll message every once in a while and be like, hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And I always get the raw, uncensored, you know, this is how it is, no BS explanation. And he's going to give some of that to you today. So without further ado, I want to recognize my good buddy, Dr. Ian Wright, who is taking this call up in Maine. And we're just going to get right down to it. So, morning, Doc. How are you, sir?
Good morning. Good morning. It's always fun to do this with you. The last one I really enjoyed. So I'm kind of looking forward to this. And you got me. I told you I didn't want to know anything about it. So I'm getting the raw questions and you'll get the completely off the cuff answers.
That I would expect nothing less. And that's exactly what we're going for. So let's just jump right into this. And one of the things I wanted to get into with you is like common injuries, common things that you've seen, common remedies in the field, any stories, war stories, whatever you want to call them, for things that we've seen in classes that you might have seen in the ER or in the operating room or whatever it may be. So let's just talk about one of the first things, and I want to talk about cold-related injuries. So last night, I was working with my buddy Andy. Andy is a local Green Beret, and he asked me to help out at this group that does trail life programs. So I showed these kids cold water, hand immersion, and then they had to make a fire with one match. And all these kids were absolutely amazing. These kids are like 13 to 18. So what have you seen in regards to cold weather being up in Maine? Ways, I don't know, something that jumps out at you.
It's fascinating. I mean, so I think the most interesting cold weather emergencies actually don't happen in the middle of winter. You know, in the middle of winter, everybody's kind of prepared, and they even people that don't deal with really cold environments like Maine, you know that it's going to be cold in the wintertime. The more interesting ones kind of come in that season transition where people don't realize that it's cold, but it really is. And, you know, I think a number of years back, I took care of a gentleman who was from a warmer climate who decided to go kayaking that time of year and flipped and then decided he would just float down, you know, because he felt so relaxed and so relaxed all of a sudden. And he came in with a core temperature of 88. So, you know, it's this transition time that you see the more interesting cold because people don't realize it, you know.
And what's the treatment in the field? I mean, I know you can't rewarm someone too quickly, and then the opposite is true. Like you can't cool someone off too quickly, because what's the effect of that?
You don't want to. The cold is worse than the warming.
Okay.
So we used to think about this thing called when we warmed people called afterdrop, where you warm the extremities and you kind of flood the body with this lower temperature stuff that was in the extremities. That didn't turn out to be so true. So realistically, you just want to warm them as quickly as possible without burning them. And, you know, I mean, field expedient stuff is like get rid of wet clothes, warm blankets, put another human being in a sleeping bag with them. And that, you know, has to be skin to skin contact. So you can't be squeamish about it. And that's really all you got. When you get to more advanced levels of care, it's hot IV fluids, a tube in every, in both orifices or all the three orifices so that you can, you know, warm people up with warm saline. And then when it gets really extreme, you put chest tubes in, warm them up by pouring hot saline in their chest. And then the final is cardiac bypass. So if you get anywhere beyond warm blankets, you're in trouble.
Now, what about for like the more minor, which sounds so strange to say the minor cold related injuries, like frostbite.
Frostbite, frost nip.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on how bad it is. You know, I mean, you can get it. And most people don't get it too badly unless they get into a bad situation. You know, they are conscious and they can self extract to, you know, someplace warm and things like that. But if you get into trouble, you know, frostbite, frostnip, and if possible, when you take shelter, you just need to warm that in really tepid water at first. But that's, you're going to get, you know, the care of it is just bandages. Just bandage it, protect it, and understand that there will probably be some lifelong changes to whatever that extremity is.
Damn. You know, when I think of environmentals, it's not just the hot, it's not just the cold, it's also the insects. And earlier this month, I was up at the SIG Academy. I was teaching a modern survival skills class up there, and a student set up a shelter during the shelter portion of the class. And then next thing you know, I see him kind of like walk quickly toward me, and I'm like, what the heck's going on? He goes, well, remember what you said about the five W's, the wind, the water, the wiggles, the widowmakers, and the wood? He goes, well, yeah, I just found the wiggles, and there were a whole bunch of yellow jackets. Do you find, or have you found, that there's one type of bee or one type of wiggle in the environment that causes outdoorsmen the greatest concern or like the greatest harm?
I think if you worry, you know, if you're going to worry about something, you know, in this area where I'm in Maine, you know, you worry about Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that, you know, when you target, and we have a lot of ticks. I mean, if you're out in the woods, you're going to get a tick on you. So you have to be conscious of that. you know, as you get further south to the mid-Atlantic, you know, get concerned about things like eastern equine encephalitis and stuff like that. But, you know, realistically, as you go further south, there's less Lyme disease. You know, there's some other tick-borne stuff. But, you know, the chances of you getting anything are really, really low. And if you're careful and you check yourself for ticks, it really shouldn't be a problem.
What's that one tick-borne illness? Is it beta gow or something like that, where you can't consume red meat? And then if you get
bit, that happened to a buddy of mine. I don't know if I would survive.
Right? Like,
yeah.
And apparently, what do they say? Like, if you get bitten once, they can treat it, but it takes like 6 months. But then if you get bitten a second time, then it's lifelong, right? I think someone told me that.
Yeah, well, you get sensitized, right? So you end up having a real legit allergic reaction to red meat. So because it confers this antibody, or you have a reaction that makes that antibody. And then and so that happened to a buddy of mine, and it's much more common in the mid-Atlantic area, actually. You know, so that's kind of a frightening one.
Yeah. I don't think, I've met two or three people who have gotten that. And they said that it's terrifying, because what is the reaction that a person has? Like, when we say like an allergic reaction, is it anaphylactic, or is it?
Oh yeah, it can be anaphylactic, you know, so throat swelling, can't breathe, got to carry an EpiPen with you, you know, things like that.
If you come in contact with red meat.
Correct.
Unreal. Now, aside from the ticks, down here in the South, we've got, you know, all sorts of fire ants. And then, you know, there are chiggers. And then...
Oh, yeah.
Which
I trained in surgery in South Carolina. And the number of little critters out there that'll get you. In fact, you know, where I trained, we would do a lot of the snake bites.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always fascinating when you think about it in the South. And it's never, you know, it's not the funny thing is, it's not the adult snakes that you worry about, because they bite and they usually don't venomate. It's the juveniles. And most bad snake bites that I see are somebody surprising or messing around with a juvenile. In the South, it was copperheads.
Mm-hmm.
or water moccasin. And the juveniles are the ones that are really, they deliver their entire venom load no matter what. So they just don't have the experience. And they would create some very bad snake bites.
you know, I think there's so much attention that's paid to snakes because they have venom. And down here, we've got the Black Widow. And I mean, it's when I first got here to North Carolina about last year, around this time, I was like, where are these Black Widows? And now that I've been down here, I could pretty much go into the field and find the habitat and turn over a log, turn over a rock, turn over a tarp that's in the ground, and I can find a Black Widow on command. So there's a lot of attention paid to the venomous creatures that are out there. But have you seen, or what I should say is, like, what's the risk of getting bitten by something that's non-venomous? Now, it sounds crazy probably to the listeners, but like a squirrel.
My favorite one is always, I will tell you, and I didn't mean to run right over you there, Kevin, but the funniest out of all of these is the often, you know, missed, quote unquote, brown recluse spider bite. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as soon as somebody mentions brown recluse on the news, like, the entire country has a brown recluse spider bite. And it's always funny when, you know, you would get called, and I would get called even up here in Maine. I always think it could be a brown recluse spider bite. It's like, well, you should probably call the Smithsonian, because they don't even exist, and this is not anywhere near their habitat. So it's not that. But it happens, and it's kind of funny when people do that.
So back to that question.
Yes.
The non-venomous bites that are out there. I'm sure there's got to be stories, there's got to be tales of people who have gone onto their trash can and then, like, a possum bit them, or a raccoon bit them, or, you know, they're at their bird feeder and a squirrel jumps on them, or, you know, you're ice fishing and a pike decides to chomp down on your hand or fingers.
Right.
Have you seen anything like that, or like, what's the protocol for that? I mean, is it just flush it, antibiotics, that type of thing?
Yeah, it's just wash it and keep it clean. You know, a lot of ice fishing up here, so, you know, the pike are just can be incredibly aggressive. They're fun to fish for, but you certainly don't want to get caught by their teeth, which has happened. So the non-venomous stuff, you know, is probably going to be your most common if you have a bite from an animal. Mm-hmm. The concerning ones are skunks, bats, and raccoons. So those are your three high-risk animals. And they, you know, a bite from one of them is rabies until proven otherwise. Usually they'll try and treat you for that at first. So those are the concerning ones. Other than that, you know, it's kind of just rinse it off. And fish and maritime stuff, just rinse it off, depending on what you get bit by. I saw there's quite the snapping turtle that climbed onto my lawn this past summer. So you can certainly lose a digit from one of those guys.
At what age and at what size? Like, are we talking dinner plate size? We'll already put a hurting on you, or like dessert plate size, or
serving platter size?
My gosh. You know,
it's probably about 25-pound snapper.
And you know something, and that snapper, 25 pounds, is probably about 120 years old, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I know people that are like, oh, I'll just kill snappers or whatever. I'm like, that thing is freaking old. You know, I'd rather relocate it and let it live somewhere in some pond that no one goes to and live a healthy life there. Yeah. I feel bad killing a super old animal like that.
You know, I think if you're going to kill it, have a reason to harvest it. You know, I mean, if you're going to eat it, fine. If you're going to use it for something, fine. Yeah, but if you're going to kill it just because you don't like it, doesn't make sense. They do serve a purpose in the environment. So,
yeah, there's another illness related to turtles, right? Like, if you handle turtles, you can get, what is it, salmonella, or
you're thinking of armadillos.
Armadillos. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Which is interesting. Leprosy.
What
you worry about? What armadillos carry?
As in, like, you're losing digits, they're falling off, skin's like...
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot, you know, all of that's very durable now, but it's, but it's that leprosy, that's the one.
With armadillos, like, now that animal is one that, the first time I saw one, I was like, that's like the coolest thing. It's basically a possum with body armor, you know? Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that they were so prevalent in Texas. I just did the Chad Robichaud podcast, and I saw a bunch of them that were hit by cars on the side of the road. But I didn't realize that if you handle armadillos, there's leprosy. Is there any other thing that people should worry about in terms of handling animals here on the East Coast or maybe even on the West Coast, like different
regions? I mean, when you think about, you think about the West Coast, you think about things like hantavirus and the small rodents and, you know, causing respiratory disease. We still have it. Here's the funny thing. I mean, every year there's still like one or two cases of bubonic plague. And we, you know, I mean, it's like one or two in the world, but it still happens. So, you know, it's all that kind of interesting stuff. You know, when you talk about it, you worry that everybody's going to be so annoyed about going over it. Again, the chances of contracting all of this are really slim to none. And then what you do about it, especially in a field, you know, under field conditions, you know, is the fascinating thing. And that's, you know, I harp on this because it drives me crazy. You know, people buy these big med kits and they have no idea how to use anything in them. And you think under a stress situation, you're going to magically have this medical knowledge to save a life. And I just kind of laugh, you know, when people waste their money on those things. You know, you're really so much better off with the basics, like, can you stay hydrated? You know, can you walk? You know, can you protect yourself, make a fire, et cetera? You know, all of those things. Can you deal with some pain? You know, do you have some over-the-counter pain relievers? You know, can you, you know, dress a wound? You know, that's the simple stuff that everybody knows how to use and will be the only thing you can have the mental space to manage in an emergency. You know, and anything beyond that, forget it, unless you have specific training. You know, it's just not going to happen. And even me, you know, I mean, I'm a surgeon and, you know, I can't, you know, unless somebody wants to bring the operating room out into the woods, there's only so much you can do, you know, without the tools of your trade. So, you know, can I do a little bit more? Yes. But again, it's not gonna, you know, it's not gonna last and it's not durable. And the, you know, the biggest thing is to make sure that somebody's safe until you get them to a less austere environment.
Yeah. There's a fantasy out there that people think that they're going to become their own doctor. They're going to have a few supplies. I mean, I mean, as a First Blood, a Rambo fan, I mean, I remember watching that as a kid thinking like, oh, if I ever fall off of a cliff evading the sheriff, I'm going to fall through a tree and then I'll have to just suture my arm with a fish hook, which I always thought it was a needle. But in all the comments, they say that he was pushing a fish hook through his body. You're obviously opposed to anyone trying to suture themselves, right?
Oh, I think, first of all, I don't know why you would do it, right? So you know, if you're going to be, if you can get to something within 24 hours, why would you ever suture yourself? You know, if you're in an austere environment and an open wound is going to hinder your progress to safety, I can see, you know, that. But most of the time, you know, addressing is really what you want. The minute you close something, you close that space, and without proper cleaning and maybe sometimes antibiotics, depending on the wound, you know, you're just increasing a risk of infection. And then, you know, you're in a austere environment. You sewed this thing up 2 days ago. Now it's infected. What do you got to do? Then you just got to reopen it. So it's better to do things like delayed primary closure and just put a dressing on. I mean, if you're not at one of the poles, you know, in the jungles of Borneo or in an incredibly austere environment somewhere, you're going to get to a doctor in time to have it closed nicely, properly, and under better conditions.
What about minor surgery? And what I'm talking about is like removing things from the body.
You know what minor surgery is? This is a joke in surgery. Minor surgery is on someone other than me.
So what about like blisters? What's your advice?
Blisters are the age old blister question.
Yeah. Right?
So what do you do about a blister? And the military would tell you pop it, you know, but I will tell you absolutely do not pop a blister. It's that's the cleanest, most sterile dressing your body can have. You know, they'll pop at the right time. But you know, that blister is your body's way of saying, you know, I need to make some space here, and this is my response to inflammation. That fluid in there is nice and sterile until you stick something in it, and then it's not sterile anymore. You know, I'll hold up my lighter underneath the tip of my knife blade and things like that. If anybody believes that's remotely sterile, they're out of their mind. I mean, it's better than nothing, but it's certainly not, you know, any reason to do. There's just no reason to pop blisters. And it's one of those funny things that people get it in their head. They know how to manage blisters, and nobody really does.
So then what would be the better course of action? Build up like a...
Pad
it like with a moleskin and...
Yeah, moleskin's good. And that's really, you know, if you can pad them, that's great. If you can't, you never say never, right? So if the blister is going to impede movement out of a bad situation, pop the blister, do what you have to do. And understand that if you're going to be somewhere less austere within 24 hours, you know, basically you're safe, right? I mean, you're not going to get an infection. Potentially you could, things like necrotizing fasciitis, but it's unlikely to get a progressive, really bad infection, popping blisters. So, you know, again, try to leave it in place. But if you got to pop it because it's impeding movement, pop it, and then, you know, try not, you know, keep it clean. Soap and water. You know, everybody buys all these expensive disinfectants and things like that. And, you know, really you just need soap and water. The only things hurt by soap and water were my children when they were little. You know, other than that, for wounds, soap and water is the best.
Kind of along the same line as like a blister, what about like removing a splinter? And I'll tell you a quick story. When I was a little kid, you know, I was probably, I'd say, gosh, like 8 or 9 years old. And I remember I was on a wooden deck, and what I did was I was crawling up the wooden deck, like up the stairs, and I got this huge, huge splinter in the top of my kneecap. And I was like, don't take it out. Don't take it out. I was so much in pain. Well, I remember waking up. This is like maybe a traumatizing thing, but it's actually kind of funny now that I think about it. I remember waking up. I fell asleep on like my parents' couch. And I remember they were spraying something on my knee, like some type of like topical, you know, analgesic. And then my dad was like, you know, scraping away at it. And they eventually got the splinter out. But I remember thinking like, oh my God, this was wild. Like I just woke up and I had this giant piece of wood that was in my skin. I've heard people say certain splinters will be absorbed by the body. I've heard people say, don't touch it, remove it at home. I've heard people say, do what you got to do in the field. What are your thoughts on splinters?
Yeah, so it depends on the splinter, right? So if the splinter is, 1 inch around and, you know, 3 feet long and it's going through your chest, that probably needs to be left in place. If the splinter is under the skin on your finger, that's something that I would get rid of. I think a pair of tweezers. Again, a magnifying glass in your kit serves multiple purposes, right? So you can look at that tweezer and take it out with some effectiveness, you know, and you can start a fire with your Fresnel lens, your magnifying glass, whatever. But either way, you get some magnification for getting rid of that splinter, you know, and then soap and water, right? So yeah, really the simple stuff, it's the stuff everybody's grandparents taught them about first aid, that we get so caught up in the, you know, and all the clicks on Instagram and this medical kit and that medical kit. It just, you know, and, oh, you can do minor surgery in the field with this medical kit. Well, if you're not a surgeon, it's kind of hard. And, you know, when YouTube, you can't bring a YouTube up in the field sometimes. And so, you know, I think about that stuff, and you really want to equip yourself with the basics unless you have more than basic training. And then think about what your environment is going to be. You know, and you know, prepare appropriately, kind of predict what emergencies you have. And most of the stuff you have in the field or when hiking or camping and that kind of thing, what is it? It's injuries to your hand because you're using a knife, right? And then slip, trip, and fall kind of stuff. So I broke my arm, I broke my ankle, I twisted my ankle. you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then, yeah, but that's different from a day at the range, right? You go to a bunch, you go to a range to sight in your firearms with a bunch of friends, you're going to carry a different med kit. You know, that's more of a stop the bleed type kit, so, or a blowout pack. So I think people get, you know, caught up in the novelty of all of the stuff out there, only to miss the fact that it's the really straightforward, you know, stuff that stops you from breathing, stuff that stops your heart, and things that make you leak the red stuff, you know, be able to temporize all of that, you know. And then if you're going on a trip, think about the kind of stuff you can get, you know, ask your doctor, hey, I'm going on this trip, do I need to take any antibiotics with me? A lot of places will have, you can do that over the phone now, so it doesn't cost you a doctor's visit to do that. And I think that's a really good, you know, that's a really good way to reach out to, you know, rural communities and those of us that get outdoors. Like, I don't want to go for a doctor's visit to ask about what if I'm going to the Southwest, but I could love to talk on the phone. So, you know, I think you have to think about where you're going and what you're going to do. What are the basics of, you know, your capabilities, and what are the needs going to be for that particular mission, whether it is a, you know, hiking, you know, search and rescue, family camping, et cetera, et cetera.
Hey, everyone. Vigits, how are you? This is Nate, and I'm going to take a quick minute and talk about the sponsor of today's podcast. Quick question for you. If you call someone who speaks three languages trilingual and someone who speaks two languages bilingual, what do you call someone who speaks one language? American. Just kidding, but not really, because it's around 22% of Americans who speak a language other than English at home. But this fall, you can learn a new language and be the exception, not the rule, with Babbel. Babbel is conversation-based learning, built with science-backed cognitive tools like spaced repetition and interactive lessons created by real language teachers and voiced by real native speakers. I've used so many different language tools throughout the years, all the way back to when I was a teenager, Googling common phrases, printing them out without pronunciation guides. That was super fun. Using CDs and different things. Rosetta Stone and the military would give us pronunciation guides along with our little smart books as we would travel from place to place. A little bit more helpful, but not really. I can say throughout the years, one of my favorite tools that I've come across is by far Babbel. Quick 10-minute lessons help me fit language learning into my day so I can stay consistent. You can customize how intense or simple you want your learning plan to be based to suit your interests. But most importantly, I enjoy learning the language skills along with the context, traditions, and culture of the language that I'm trying to learn. That's the only thing that makes me feel like I'm going to understand the language is understanding the traditions that it's grounded in. Developed by over 150 expert linguists, Babbel gives you unlimited access to hundreds of award-winning lessons designed for all learners based on level and time commitment. You can start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners to get you started right now. You can get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/fieldcraft. Get 55% off at babbel.com/fieldcraft. Spelled babbel.com/fieldcraft. Rules and restrictions may apply. Thanks so much for your time. Now back to our conversation.
I agree with you on that one. Like if you can it make things easier. And I think we talked about this last time, or maybe we talked about it on the phone since the last podcast about having those like ready packs made, like, okay, take this if you have diarrhea, take this if you are feeling sick, that type of thing. So much of medicine, I think, has changed since COVID, and with the resurgence of like the new COVID that people are talking about. I mean, I think medicine has changed forever because of that. What are your thoughts on, and I don't know if you want to answer this one or not, what are your thoughts on the use of masks on an airplane and use of masks in public? I mean, is there one that you prefer? Is there some advice that you're like, okay, that was just foolish? Is there some advice where you're like, well, that makes sense?
Right. So when we look back, on COVID.
Mm-hmm.
What's the stuff that we learned? So one of the things that we did learn, and, you know, I will not, you know, the one thing I try to stay away from is the whole mask debate, but.
Well, it's a good thing I brought it up, huh?
Yeah. I'll say it in that I'll talk about the flu, right? So COVID is a pain in the ass, but we have far more people get and die from flu. So do I habitually wear a mask? I absolutely do not. But what I will say is when during COVID, which I was very involved in from a surgical standpoint, I operated on some of the very first people that had COVID bowel perforations and things like that. What I will say is that one of the things that we did learn from COVID was masking decreased all, like we had almost no flu those 2 years. So was it the masking? I don't know. Is it kind of a Hawthorne effect because we're so aware? It may be that, and everybody's kind of washing their hands. I don't think there's any one particular magic bullet to any of this. What I will say is during cold and flu season, being somebody that's in a higher risk environment and deals with higher risk patients, I haven't run into this since we relaxed everything, but would I wear a mask during peak times for like cold, flu, COVID, things like that? Probably. And not necessarily because the mask is going to save my life unless you're using an N95, but you're much more likely to not touch your face with the reminder on. And it's all the things put together. It's touching surfaces, hand hygiene, and all of this stuff. They really, we were supposed to do all the time in hospitals, and, you know, people should do and be careful where they cough and things like that. So I think it's a conglomeration of all those. And the mask is really kind of a symbol of, okay, make sure you do all this stuff. And it might help a little bit, unless you're talking about something like a KN95.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're fighting off a cold yourself.
No, a little bit. It's just the change in seasons up here in Maine, and I'll go through this period of where I'm a little congested in the mornings.
I remember that was something that parents used to say all the time, like, put a jacket on, you're going to get sick. And I don't know what the, is there any science behind that with the,
is it just that your grandmother said to them and then they passed it on to you? And yeah, I mean, disease and those things like that come from, either aerosolized or airborne or, you know, fomites, which is things that you can touch. So, that's kind of an old wives. So I guess the point to that is, you know, if you're all run down because you've been exposed and your immune system is not going to be at its tip top. So there's a little kernel of truth in what grandma used to say with 90% BS.
All right. So now catch me off guard with something here. I mean, I've brought up ice fishermen and the idea of like getting bitten by a pike. And we've talked a little bit about, the elephant in the room, which is COVID. And, you know, we've talked about, the travel medicine and whatnot. What's something that is an outdoor pursuit that in the ER or in the OR you've had to deal with where you're like, oh my gosh, people need to do this because I've seen it so many times?
Yeah, you know, it's hard, right? So I would say, you know, when I was in the South, I think we would find a lot of people down out of tree stands during hunting season. So, yes, simple, you know, again, it's always a simple, stupid little things like clip yourself into your tree stand. Kind of be careful. You know, it's common sense things, or when you deviate from your, you know, kind of what you do every day, or what you know is right, or you try and kind of rush it. That's when the little injuries occur. I think, you know, when you think about the most commons, it's going to be like hand and then slip, trip, fall, and then those kind of things. You know, there's always invariably some firearms incidental discharges during hunting season.
Mm-hmm.
While people are cleaning their weapons, usually in my experience, they're not exactly sober when they're doing it. And that's when you see injuries like that, or they're cleaning their sidearm. We see that. And really the rest is kind of bumps and bruises, you know, ATV injuries, things like that.
You know, you're mentioning alcohol there, like when people are under the influence. What about injuries that are sustained just from the alcohol itself? You know what I mean? Like, I know there are people out there where they're like, okay, I remember there was one guy on a camping trip and he was really drunk, right? And I remember being told in health class in high school, if you ever see a kid at a party and they're really drunk and they're vomiting, put them in the recovery position, but never let them fall asleep just on their back, that type of thing. Do you have any advice for anyone who might be traveling, camping in a hunting camp, whatever it may be, or women's retreat, which I have to say, the women do like to drink on those retreats,
right,
where they've had too much to drink. Like, what is the best solution to dealing with a drunk?
Yeah. If they're like that, don't take them with you, first of all. But, you know, I mean, these things happen and, you know, people show up and, you know, you've seen it, I've seen it, you know, they show up and, you know, for a class or a course and, you know, somebody's brought some alcohol and, you know, somebody drinks too much at night around the campfire and then you got to figure out what to do with them. You know, most people, unless they're really at pro status, will pass out before it becomes too dangerous. And yeah, I think that, you know, having them sleep on their side or their stomach and, you know, having somebody watch out for them is really the key. there are people that have, you know, real problems with alcohol and drink themselves, you know, almost to death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, there's, if you have EMS close enough, that's the time for that. Basically, if somebody's unconscious and unarousable, and we've all taken care of our drunk friend. Some of us have been that drunk friend a couple of times. You know, I'm not going to give away any names. So I think that, you know, it's the common sense things. Again, it's the, you know, when they can hydrate, they need to hydrate. Coffee doesn't take away being intoxicated, by the way. It just makes you really awake and intoxicated. So, you know, pouring a bunch of coffee into them, we want to just hydrate them and make sure the liver is doing a good job of processing that alcohol out. Don't give them Tylenol. You really don't want to give Tylenol when you're drinking because it increases the amount of toxicity or decreases the threshold for it to become toxic. So, alcohol and Tylenol are not good. Motrin is great. You know, I tell people all the time, I'm going to give away my hangover prevention. So it's a little, you know, 25 milligrams of Benadryl, which is the nighttime sleep aid. You know, also it's good for allergies. So 25 of Benadryl. And all this is over the counter. I'm not giving any medical advice. So, you know, when I see somebody like that, 25 of Benadryl and, you know, some Zantac or some Pepcid and a couple of Motrin. And, you know, that's the best you can do. You know, again, if you're worried about their airway, if you're worried that they can't breathe and things like that, activating the EMS system is really the way to go, or starting some sort of rescue or extraction plan is really kind of the way to go.
Wow. I never heard that with Benadryl before. And I've heard people say like, oh, to cure for the hangover, just give them Tylenol in the morning. I didn't realize that increases the toxicity. Does it just prolong the effect?
You know, when you're drinking and, you know, for about 6 hours after, you really want to stay away from Tylenol, if possible. It's not good for the liver. But you're right. Not a lot of people know that. Not a lot of people know you gotta watch out for the toxic threshold for Tylenol, which is 4 grams in a day. So you can't take anything more than 1,000 milligrams every 6 hours, or you cross the toxicity threshold for Tylenol.
Man, it's interesting. You know, I'm just thinking of the other combinations out there that could be toxic for the human body. I mean, is there something that's just so out there, so common that you see where people mix this and mix that, and they don't realize that it has serious consequences?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it in a while. But frequently that involves cleaning fluids and cleaning solutions. People decide to mix things together like ammonia and bleach, mm-hmm. And then they end up with respiratory injuries. As far as mixing things together, and ingesting them, generally it's not that bad. I have seen a couple of cases of just over 20 years, maybe one or two, of people eating mushrooms. If you're not an experienced mushroomer or with somebody who is, there might be one species of mushroom that you can readily identify. You want to be really sure when you pick and eat mushrooms out of the woods, because that can end up in disaster with things like liver transplantation and, very unpleasant consequences. So, basically, if you haven't put it in your mouth 30 times before and you're not in a survival situation, don't do it.
My friend Orion out in Colorado, he's one of the guys I went on that backcountry altitude fishing trip with a couple months ago. He's a huge mushroomer, and he talks about, having secret spots for mushrooms, and he's got them all plugged into his Onyx, and that's like very protected stuff. But I think there's a general fear of mushrooms or misunderstanding of mushrooms. Like, people think, okay, I'm going to take a mushroom and I'm going to start hallucinating. And it's like, I think those mushrooms only grow in a certain part of the world. I don't know if we have anything growing like that here. But I think the greater threat with mushrooms is that you have those poisonous lookalikes. And
yes,
I think what's the one that everyone talks about? Is it nightcap or death cap or something like that?
Yeah. Well, really, you're talking about the foxglove family, which tomatoes are also in that family. But mushrooms are the same thing. A lot of these things, what's the safe stuff? Okay, if you see a segmented berry in North America, you're safe, right?
Right.
So blueberries, raspberries, not blueberries, but blackberries, raspberries, all that, ground, wild strawberries, they're segmented. You just need to be careful. There's, Peterson's Guide, I think, is probably the best comprehensive guide to that kind of thing. But I don't, you can look at the one for medicinal plants and things like that. My thing is, if you don't have a lot of experience in this, find somebody who does, learn from them before you do or try any of that stuff or make any concoctions. There's simple stuff, aloe that everybody knows about, things like that. But if you're not really sure about it, you want to make sure you're dealing with somebody, or you learn from somebody that really knows what they're doing, or just don't do it for a while. It's not something you're going to learn from a YouTube video in an hour.
You mentioned aloe, which is great for burns. Have you seen or have you tried any of those in the field, like sun protection methods, like mixing charcoal with water and like putting that paste on there? Like, have you seen anything like that you could say, that definitely works?
I haven't done that. People pay a lot of money to get covered in charcoal
paste. Yeah, they do.
little did we know, we could be, this is your sun protection. If I'd have known all of this, I'd be a millionaire. But I think, I kind of laugh, because a lot of people want to be completely back to nature and they don't want to use And that's fine. You know, I mean, if that's how you choose to live it, that's great. Personally, the older I get, the more I want to also be comfortable when I'm out in the woods. So I tend to use the sunblock and those kind of things that don't make me feel greasy or sticky. I really don't want to be covered in muddy charcoal. But there's a whole deal with doing it traditionally, which I think is really valuable. Excuse me, to learn a lot of that. To know that I can do this if the need arises, and I practice this if the need arises, I think that's pretty cool. But we should take advantage of the fact that it's 2023. I mean, we don't have to, we don't have to lug around a giant steel frame pack. I mean, we have better ways to heat our food and to store our food when we camp, hike, travel, and things like that. So, you know, I love taking care of taking advantage of technology. I also enjoy understanding the basics. So, you know, is there a place for all those things? Yeah, if you need it, if you want to do it because it's cool, if you want to learn how to do it, I think that's awesome. But don't throw away all the technology. Is not bad. You just got to pick and choose.
And I think that's kind of like an overarching theme with so much of what we do. You know, like you go out there and you learn the hard way of doing it, which then in turn makes you go home and say, okay, well, there's got to be an easier way. And maybe you throw something new in your pockets. And then next time you go out, you learn something else the hard way. And then it's like a constant cycle of testing
right,
something
now,
in the field.
I can tell you, you know, it's funny. So you did my first bow drill class, mm-hmm. where I actually got the fire started. But the one thing I learned about all of that, which was an amazing process, it's a lot of fun. You never realize how tired you get until you have to do that. And, you know, when I did that, I was in really good shape. So, you know, I was like, wow, it's exhausting. And the one thing I learned, the most important thing I learned about the bow drill, from the bow drill, was that I hated it so much that in any situation, I mean, if you dig around, I bet you there's 6 ways to start a fire in my truck. You know, just because I never wanted to touch that bow drill outside of a class ever. Yeah, if it gets to that point, you're in a lot of trouble. I'll probably just lay down and die in the woods before I do the damn bow drill again. But, the point to that is that it's so distasteful and such an amazing energy expenditure that I think, man, I really don't want to do that. So, you know, you end up carrying stuff to avoid what's most unpleasant for you.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think there's an understanding that, like, when you do the bow drill, it's a huge time investment too. And sometimes you just don't have that time. You know, like, if I have all the materials in front of me, if you said, here's your uncarved fireboard, here's your uncarved spindle, here's your bow, here's your socket, make a fire, here's your tinder bundle, it's still going to take me minutes, where I'd rather just reach into my pocket, grab a lighter, and have fire in seconds. And that's something that's so important. I mean, and again, there's that universal concept of, do you want to spend minutes or seconds resolving a problem? Same thing applies with medicine. Like, do you want to do things the hard way, or do you want to have a solution now and have a better chance of surviving or getting that quality of life back? We were just talking about mushrooms and toxicity, and I had something else I was going to ask you about. Not mushrooms and toxicity, but it was along that line. So I don't know how I just thought of this one, but like a common thing that could happen. You're talking about people being drunk on ATVs. And then we got to the mushrooms, but going back to those ATVs and vehicles, what about injuries that are sustained while working on cars or working on ATVs, working on motorcycles and things like that?
Yeah, most of those, again, they're going to be knuckle busters. But when you talk about, you know, what's bad in situations like that, it's going to be, you know, body parts. And there's entire lectures on this. And it's, you know, mostly the pictures are the most interesting to see. But it's, you know, PTO injuries, things that turn and rotate in, you know, mechanical objects, like, you know, augers and PTO injuries. And especially when we see, you know, some of the modern vehicles or modern outdoors type vehicles, so trucks and things like that, some of them will have a separate PTO. Some of them will have something where you can run a generator off of their PTO. So there's all these things that move, spin, have fan blades, et cetera. And then also engines are hot, right? So you can have the big stuff that you worry about is burn injuries, how to take care of a burn injury, and, you know, things getting caught in PTOs. And that's, you know, again, another reason, and having been to some of these courses on, you know, farm injuries and rural injuries, you know, the pictures say everything. For example, somebody was stepping over a PTO. And you can imagine the injury that occurs when you step over a spinning PTO. So, you know, I think those are the things, again, it's going to be stabilized. Tourniquets are probably the biggest life-saving thing in this area. You know, if you have a mangled extremity and it's just bleeding away, you certainly should know how to put a tourniquet on. And that's something, you know, tourniquets, I will always plug tourniquets because they save lives. And we should be teaching that in kindergarten. Yeah, I mean, these should be skills, you know, pull the fire alarm, kids, this is how you do this. Pull the fire alarm, put on a tourniquet, you know, call for help. Those are the things that save lives. And, you know, I think when you're talking about the biggest threat to life and the biggest advantage that we have when we're out in the field is the tourniquet, you know, whether it's an improvised tourniquet or, you know, I suggest buying a real one and having, you know, a few CAT tourniquets all the time. And again, you know, buy them from someplace reputable. Do not buy knockoff tourniquets.
We had a knockoff in a class recently, and the student didn't even know it was a knockoff. And Jerry said, "See this?" And he pointed out where and how it was different than an authentic one. And people are getting away with it. Like, Amazon is not taking them down because they're very clever. The seller is very clever with disguising how they market it. And it's technically not a violation of the Amazon rules, but it's more like buyer beware. You should have known. You bring up an interesting point with all these machines, and it's something that it freaks me out. Like, whenever I teach cordage and I teach knots and showing people how to tie things together, one of the things that scares me is when people will take a rope, they'll wrap it around their arm, their finger, their hand, and they'll pull. And I'm like, you don't want to do that for the same reason why sailors don't wear rings, you know, and machinists don't wear rings, because you'll deglove yourself if that ever gets caught.
Yeah. Well, you can spot them, right? I mean, probably every few years I see a patient for, excuse me, whatever. And, yeah, they're missing a finger, and invariably they're like a machinist or they work around machinery like that. And it's always their wedding finger, cause they wore a wedding band. So, you know, that definitely happens.
I mean, is the solution then just wear the ring around your neck or get one of those, silicone rings?
You can get one of those silicone rings. You can wear it around your neck. Although, you know, when you think about things being worn around the neck and scarves and that kind of thing, and the types of things that can happen with that, it's a whole different story. You really don't want to get clothing caught up in machinery either.
Yeah, the thing that scared me the other day, a good friend of mine, I won't say his name, but you know him, we'll talk offline. His daughter was sitting up on the kitchen counter and they were making a pecan pie, and the daughter's got this like beautiful long hair, little kid, right? And
yep.
The KitchenAid, that motor is powerful. Like, that KitchenAid motor, right. I mean, I'm watching it. I'm like, oh my God. Like, she had that long hair, and I can only imagine that hair getting caught and like having to run over there and yank the cord from the wall. I've seen some terrible stuff happen to people with long hair. And as you mentioned, like, there was a story not too long ago of someone jumping off of a ski lift with a scarf around their neck, and the scarf didn't give, person got hanged, you know? It's so, all these accidents are so freak, and you wouldn't think about it. And then when you tell people like, hey, be careful about that. And they're like, well, what are you, paranoid? It's like, no, I'm just informed. I've seen
it. Well, then, you know, then you have a job like mine and you're a parent, you know, and then and you've seen all the different things that can happen to people. And, you know, and then you see your kids kind of go off into the world or start driving and that kind of thing. And it's like, oh my God, I'm having a heart attack every time they walk out the door. But you can't, you know, I mean, you can't do it. You gotta, you know, I talk about all this stuff, but the reality is that, you know, doctors, nurses, paramedics, firefighters, cops, we all see this very narrow swath of what's out there. And we get a little, you know, we have a tendency or we can be a little judgmental and, you know, say, gosh, there's so much of this. When in reality, your chances of having anything like this happen is really low. Again, you know, I mean, people have training and they carry the basic stuff. You know, for a reason, right? We all have insurance. Do we expect to have a car crash? No, we don't expect to have a car crash. But these things are insurance and provide you with choices. You know, like, okay, it's not an I don't have, you know, no option here. The only thing I can do is frantically try to dial 911 on my phone and begin to in whatever situation. So the biggest thing is like temporizing and providing yourself with options by getting trained. And that's really the key, you know, all training, just it's not about learning something new. It's always about providing options for what you can do, you know, and especially in medicine and kind of field survival or field medicine. And really, it's field first aid, right? So you want to be that first responder, that person who gets there and arrests the process of what is ending someone's life. Or you want to be prepared when it happens around you. Or you want to be prepared for when it's you.
Right.
You know, and I think that's a whole different, you know, scenario. And I frequently will tell people, look, if you are going on a trip with a bunch of people and you all have first aid kits, you know, start out and agree where you're going to keep them, you know, and make sure it's the same thing or try to make it the same thing on everybody. So you're not figure out where your first aid kit is on each person, you know, and then practice with that stuff, right? What's in it? What's in the, you know, what's in the various and sundry bags? Make sure you open it up, look at it, you know, get demonstrators of things, you know, take a course. It's fun.
We just did a shotgun class down here in North Carolina at Griffin Group, and Jerry is our lead medic on those classes, lead instructor. But I mean, we had probably the best medical team on that class. Luckily, we never needed it, but we had a doctor, like a local country doctor. Shout out to Arthur, yeah, who also won the Top Shot Award. We had Izan, who's probably going to become one of our regular instructors because he's taken everything in the course catalog. He's a emergency room nurse. Then we had a retired fire department or FDNY officer from 9/11 who, I mean, he's seen everything. So, I mean, we had such an amazing group of medics, and thank God we didn't need them. But something that, speaking of Griffin Group over there, that we were talking about doing with one of the instructors, he's like, how would you guys like to run a course where you have to do care in the back of a vehicle while that vehicle is moving on a track or an off-road course? He's like, cause you know what? It could happen. And I started thinking, like, that would be a wild class. Cause you know, training is great when you're in a sterile classroom and you've got, you know, temperature control and you've got right. All the resources right there. But like having to do care or having to perform something while a vehicle is moving, and especially when it's bumping and it's uncomfortable, like that's gotta bring on a whole host of new protocols and procedures and how you stage things, because
so it's very different, right? So you know, when you talk about environments where you're under duress, whether it's a SEER type situation or a you know, any other, you know, a large casualty incident of whatever situation. I mean, you want to make sure, does the person have a pulse? Do they have an airway? You know, and are they breathing? And that's it. Yeah, and then you got to move on to the next one. If you're talking about multiple casualties, if you're talking about caring for one individual person, I mean, what are you going to do, you know, as you are moving along? And the question is, you know, do you need, what is your need to stop? And, you know, that need may vary based on, you know, the kind of situation that you're in. I mean, if you are, and a buddy of mine participates in training Ukrainian medics and in pre-hospital trauma care and things like that. So, you know, can you stop and get the air? If you're running from, you know, Russian shelling and things like that, you know, you're not going to stop that evacuation vehicle. You're going to have to make do with what you got. So, you know, but if possible, procedures should not be done, you know, when you're driving, although, you know, there's always exceptions, right? So if you're trying to escape a bait, or if you are, you know, if your person or patient's, you know, deteriorating and you need to move along, you know, the shortest time to that next level of care is really the stuff that saves people's lives. So there's a really interesting study back in Los Angeles, and this was 80s, 90s, if I recall, and they used to be, you know, the age of emergency, where, you know, the paramedic unit would pull up and you'd hook them up to everything and start IVs and do all this. And we would call that was the stay and play era, right? You would do all this stuff. And then what people realize is that the gunshot wounds and the traumatically injured people that were showing up in personal vehicle, you know, somebody just chuck them in the back of a car and, you know, drive as fast as they could to the emergency room, were actually having better outcomes than the ones that showed up via medic unit. And there was a guy in Maryland called R. Adams Cowley. That's what the Shock Trauma Center there is named after, who talked about the golden hour, you know, and that hour being, you know, the to have the highest rate of survival for the traumatically injured patient, you want to get them to definitive care within an hour. And there are some caveats to that, right? And then when you talk about wilderness or combat or austere medicine or injured, you know, or areas where you're dealing with the patient, you have to think about what your resources are and that kind of thing. But when you talk about, you know, you're at the local state park, somebody's traumatically injured, you know, they're going to want to get them to definitive care as fast as possible. So, you know, the vast majority of the things you need to know are stopping bleeding, making sure there's an airway, and really the nuts and bolts.
You know, the
rest.
I was going to say a question that comes to mind, and, you know, it's probably going to have to be the last one for the podcast, because we're running over an hour now. You know, when people go to a shooting class, or like when we run a shooting class, many times we'll say, you know, our best chance is to have their emergency vehicles intercept about halfway. So we would get someone in a vehicle and move them, right? We always say, do we wait for help? Do we bring people to that facility? Do we meet halfway? That type of thing. And I know I've been involved in different types of trainings where people will say, well, this is going to be our dedicated medical vehicle. So I guess the last question I'll have for you on this podcast is, if you were at a shooting class and someone said, hey, you're in charge of the dedicated medical vehicle, ideally, what are the attributes of that vehicle? Like, what would you want that vehicle to be, or how would you want it to be positioned? What would you want staged in there? How many people should it be able to hold, and what would their roles be?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? So I think, first of all, you have to designate your team, right? And people have to understand what their responsibilities are. So, you know, you need to have a driver. You know, if you're going to have a vehicle for evacuation, you need to have a driver, you know, and somebody who knows that's their job, is the focus on the driving. I mean, if you put some doctor in the driver's seat, that person is going to want to be involved in the medical care and may be distracted, you know, and you have to think about who you choose for each job. So that driver, you want that to be his job and his focus. There needs to be somebody who can actually do the stuff. And you can divide this up a number of different ways, right? You can say, okay, you got patient right side, you got patient left side. You know, you're doing the airway, you're doing this, you're doing that. You know, you're doing the IV, okay. And you can kind of pregame how you divide it up. And the biggest thing is just to kind of pregame it and make sure those two people have some experience if they're going to take on that responsibility. You know, when I think of vehicles, you know, realistically, anything that gets you there is okay. What can you do to prepare a vehicle? I mean, ideally it's an ambulance, right? But not too many people drive around an ambulance. So what are the attributes of your ambulance? And, you know, again, you got to think about what the training and equipment, you know, what training do you have? You know, what equipment do you have available? Do you have oxygen? I mean, do you have that capability? Is that, you know, do you have medications? Do you have, you know, what is the, you know, what is the training level of the highest trained person and what equipment do they carry with them? So that's important. And is it just an evac vehicle or do you intend to provide care in that vehicle at the same time? And, you know, what level of care can you safely provide, right? So if you can't get the person, if you don't know how to perform a definitive airway, if all you can do is put on oxygen, kind of turn somebody on their side, things like that, you know, you can put the seats down, you know, people can be on their side, you can, you know, do whatever you need to. Ideally, it's a vehicle where someone could stretch out with the seat down or the back seat down. The bed of a truck that's closed, unless you're going to go really slow. You know, I mean, there are so many different, all you got to do is really look to areas like the Ukraine where they have to figure out how to evac people in any way and with anything that they can. So, you know, and I think, you know, again, the biggest thing is to get to the next level of care as quickly as possible. And and then you need to think about what kind of environment is that vehicle in. You know, are you out in the middle of nowhere? Do you need a four-wheel drive vehicle? You know, what conditions are you going to be driving in? And then what's the experience of the driver who's driving that vehicle? So, you know, it's all this little stuff and people think, okay, we'll just have this available and be ready. And then when something bad happens, you have to go back and, you know, play the what lessons did we learn game when you can have been prepared for that in advance. And it's always interesting, you know, to see debriefs, even with experienced people. And you go, gosh, could have done that differently. Or, you know, we should be prepared in this way or that way. And you really don't want to have, you know, if you're just tweaking little things, that's great. You're doing great. But if you haven't prepared at all and something bad happens, the debrief is going to take 10 times as long as you're going to talk about how poorly prepared you were. So, you know, again, think about what you can do. Positioning a vehicle is key. You know, you want to think about positioning it in a place where you're going to be near where you're congregating, but is a protected vehicle. You know, you want to point it in the direction that you're going to go. You don't want to have to do like a 30-point turn to start getting towards help. So, you know, I mean, it's all of the little common sense things kind of put together in one, and, you know, you, kind of slowly think about that and pregame it. It's one thing if you're going away for like a weekend camping trip, but you should have a plan, and understand. Yeah, it's another thing if you're at a gun range or you're on some sort of overland trip and things like that. I mean, that's the big thing right now, right? And overlanding is really made that kind of interesting because now there's all kinds of kits that the overland companies sell. And a lot of them are really good. And I've looked through their contents. You know, and oh, by the way, just as a plug for all these companies, most of them you can buy with your health savings account or whatever pre-tax thing you're using. But the biggest thing is, know where it is. You know, when you get these kits, even the good ones, right? A good one is, you know, really helpful if you know what's in it and how to use it. But you just got to remember that in a stressful situation, you're going to be about half as good as your best training day. So, you know, if you train with this stuff a lot, you're going to be ho-hum. you're going to be acceptable, right? And there's nothing that you need beyond acceptable, right? If you stop the bleeding, that's acceptable. You stabilize an injury, that's acceptable. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to look like it did in the YouTube video when they had hours to plan it out and those kind of things. You know, somebody has a secure open airway and their bleeding is stopped and things like that. Pat yourself on the back. You know, I mean, you won. You know, and they go home alive. You win. You know, if you're not cheating, you're not playing the game right.
Dude, solid.
When it comes to this kind of thing.
Solid, you know, solid advice.
This is the way to go. And don't be focused on glitz and things like that. You know, get a good first aid kit. Go through it, take it apart, put it back together. If it doesn't make sense the way they have it, put it in the way that makes sense for you, you know, so that you know where everything is. Label it if you want to. I mean, you can get a label maker, and you know, my house is filled with these little things because I can't stand not knowing what's in boxes.
Hell yeah, man. Well, dude, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the podcast again. I know it's your day off over there and you work like a dog. So I appreciate you joining us again. And guys, if anyone wants to follow Dr. Ian, you have your Instagram up, or it's all private, or how did we do it last time? Did I tell people just to email you, or?
I think it was Instagram. A lot of people got a hold of me on Instagram. I generally will try and answer questions if somebody has a direct question, and help them out. I'm careful not to give out medical advice about things. So don't ask me medical advice. That's for your doctor. Instagram is really the best way. I follow Kevin. I think Kevin follows me. There's a whole bunch of other ways to connect with various and sundry things that I'm interested in. I will, even though I get nothing from them, and I just think they're a really great source of information on Instagram. I think North American Rescue, NAR, you'll see they'll post something, usually pictures, and then they sell tourniquets. I mean, that's a really good, in my opinion, organization to buy things from. So, and again, I don't even know them. I just think, you know, I've followed them for years, and they have a lot of good, they spread the good word about pre-hospital and field expedient care.
Solid stuff. All right, Doc. Well, thank you so much again. And for those of you guys listening, thank you so much for tuning in. And until next time, this is Kevin of Cell, Fieldcraft Survival. Thanks, guys. Take care.